back in Brazil, they continued to come to Congonhas do Campo for the pilgrimage to Arrigo. Statesmen, industrialists, actors, singers, peasants, miners, scientists, the whole broad spectrum of humanity. Roberto Carlos, the toast of the Brazilian entertainment world, chartered a plane to fly to Minas Gerais, just for the ceremony of thanking Arrigo for saving the sight of his infant boy. Ex-president Kubitschek, now back in Brazil, would bring his wife and daughter to see Arrigo, to thank him again for his help. Arrigo, in turn, unabashedly kissed Kubitschek a TMS hand for his pardon during his first pending sentence. On his 25th wedding anniversary, Arrigo went to 202 Mass with Arlette and the boys. Here the couple had their wedding rings blessed. Asked why he went to Mass in the face of the censure of the church against his work, Arrigo said, "All my family are Catholic. I alone am a Spiritist. But I believe that all religions take the people to God. So why not go to a Catholic Mass?" ATM. What he did not TMT know as he entered the church was that almost the entire town of Congonhas had prepared a surprise anniversary party for him. Two bands were playing, and dignitaries from Rio, S.A. Tilda Pondo Paulo, and below greeted him and Arlette as they came down the steps of the church after the service. It was a festive anniversary. Uncountable telegrams arrived, as some estimated as many as 10,000. Some from Europe, Argentina, and the United States. One was from the Kubitschek family, in France. On facing the profuse enthusiasm of the crowd, Arrigo surveyed the scene in disbelief. His eyes filled with tears. Then he broke down and cried openly. After the gloomy oppression of prosecution and jail, Arrigo's TMS life was taking a new turn. The newspapers and broadcasting stations gave absolute assurance of non-interference in any scientific studies that would be made on Arrigo. Word came that Arrigo would be permitted to operate under the controlled medical guidance of research surgeons. The new president of Brazil, Arthur da Costa e Silva, promised support to Arrigo. Funds were mounting in the program to build a modern hospital where Arrigo would be studied and would practice. The North American medical group at TMS knew plans for research were progressing swiftly, under foundation funding. It seemed all Arrigo at TMS helps were coming to fruition. But it was during this time that Arrigo went to bed one night and again had trouble getting to sleep. He woke Arlette and said to her, "I see that terrible black crucifix again at TM 203, 11, whatever meaning Arrigo ascribed to the image of the black crucifix, there were no sinister forebodings in the days that followed. Arrigo was able to continue with his work free from interference, in a relaxed, fruitful atmosphere. There seemed to be a tacit truce between Arrigo and those who opposed him. New support brought the hospital in Congonhas do Campo to the actual planning stage. "Ah, this is the dream of my life here, TM," Arrigo told his friends. Exhilarated by what now seemed to be a certainty, Arrigo worked with fresh vigor, never leaving his clinic until the last patient had been taken care of, often well after midnight. If the mild heart condition uncovered by the American doctors ever bothered him, he never mentioned it, not even to Dr. Godoy, who was working closely with him in coordinating the medical plans for the hospital. In the States, the Accenture Research Group at TMS plans were shaping up for the joint study with the Brazilian doctors. In September 1969, Dr. Cortes went down as an advance scout, to coordinate the arrangements. Being alone, he had no interference from the press, and he was able to gather more data. One case seemed particularly dramatic. It involved Comtesse Pamela de Maigre, an energetic and adventurous geologist from Philadelphia, who was engaged in alluvial mining for diamonds on the Jequitinhonha River in the mountains of Minas Gerais. It was a full-scale project, with heavy equipment and suction dredges. It was moderately profitable. Frequently she would be driven from Rio or below to her remote camp in the mountains by Jacques Rifford, who headed up the vast Belgian and French iron ore interests in the region, known as the Schneider Group. Rifford, a TMS chauffeur, juvenile, was a dark-skinned Brazilian of middle age, a study, squat man with a deeply lined, powerful face. He had been quite stout, but suddenly began losing weight at an appalling rate. On each trip, he looked sicker. Finally, he was persuaded by Pamela and referred to 204, go to a hospital in Rio for an examination. The x-rays showed an advanced case of stomach cancer. As an employee of the Schneider Company, he was offered complete hospital and surgical care, but he refused flatly. He had a wife and six children, and he was sure the operation would kill him. The doctors at the hospital were irritated at his stubbornness, but their prognosis was that it was a terminal case, even with the operation. Further x-rays and tests showed he was completely beyond medical help. Shortly after this, in Belo Horizonte, Juvenal asked Rifford if he could have a few days off. He would like to go and see a healer at EM in Congonhas do Campo. Juvenal was a pragmatic man, but when he had learned that he was going to die, he simply felt obligated to try every avenue of escape. Neither Rifford nor Pamela knew much about Arago at the time beyond newspaper headlines. But they urged Juvenal to try anything that would help. Juvenal later told them what had happened. He had arrived at Arago at EMS clinic, but the line was impossibly long. He gave up any thought of getting to Arago that day, but sat down on the street with the others and waited with little hope. A few hours later, Arago came out of the clinic and walked directly up to him. "You are very ill at EM," Arago told him bluntly. "A come with me immediately at EM." Without any examination, Arago gave him a prescription and told him to take the medicine, and come back the next day. Juvenal followed instructions, and reported back promptly the next morning. Arago took him into the small, almost vacant room behind his general working area. He laid him down on the crude wooden door stretched between two sawhorses. Then Arago began pressing down on his stomach with both hands. Juvenal experienced no pain, just a feeling of heavy pressure and considerable discomfort. Arago pressed with all his beefy weight, until it seemed as if the stomach wall would be pushed against the spinal column. Suddenly the stomach popped, with a clearly audible sound, like the cork of a champagne bottle. There was blood, but there was no hemorrhage. Arago reached into the upper abdomen with his hands and literally pulled out a large quantity of what 205, Juvenal described as a bloody things at EM. Arago used no instrument. Juvenal felt apprehensive, but still no pain. When Arago removed his hands, the wound closed immediately, with no stitches. Juvenal felt weak and shaken, but was able to get up and walk out of the room. He drove back to the mining camp alone, over the grueling roads, on the next day. Rifford and Pamela were open-mouthed when he told them the story. It contradicted every conceivable tenet of medical science, and they frankly felt he was fantasizing. The skin on the stomach showed only a slight mark, without any conventional scar. They remained unconvinced. Several months went by. Juvenal recovered from his shakiness, and his health obviously seemed to be returning. He was gaining weight rapidly. Rifford, his curiosity now aroused, finally persuaded Juvenal to have another X-ray taken, at the Compania TMS expense. It showed no trace whatever of anything abnormal. The man regained his full health. Another case developed after the initial North American research expedition. It involved a 9-year-old boy from Hartsdale, New York. He had suffered from major Jacksonian epilepsy since birth, which creates massive involuntary, uncontrollable spasms, although the subject remains conscious. He had received the best possible medical attention in the United States, but he continued to have 20 to 30 epileptic seizures a day. The parents were distraught and desperate. Learning about the American medical expedition to Brazil, and having been to that country several times in the past, the parents obtained Arago at EMS address, and decided to take the boy there. He was treated by Arago on May 20, 1969, and given a prescription immediately. It read, "First treatment, Rivulsin, one tablet each night, and his Zacer, one tablet each morning, Neocome tilde copyright, one ampoule, intramuscular every other day, treat for 100 days, 206, second treatment, Trivagen X, 1 tablespoon with each meal, Meteosil, ditto, Testaferan, 1 tablet after each meal, Memoriase, 1 capsule daily, treat for 2 months, third treatment, Gamibetal, inject 2.0 cc, daily, intramuscular, treat for 1 month. Again, the course of drugs was puzzling, though not entirely without logic. Rivulsin is an antispastic sedative. Antizacer is a specific for epilepsy. Neocomatilda copyright is a high-potency vitamin B complex compound. Trivagen X is used in cases of anemia. Meteosil is a fortified liver extract. Testaferan has a sedative action. Gamibetal is an anticonvulsant. It is doubtful that any conventional doctor would combine these drugs in these quantities, in fact almost certain that he would not. The first treatment was begun on the same day Arrigo wrote the prescription. The drugstore in Kangon has kept enormous stocks of Arrigo TMS unconventional drugs on hand. All previous medication the boy had been taking, such as Dilantin and Phenobarbital, was discontinued at once. Within 2 months, the boy was able to leave home for the first time in his life and go to a summer camp. By September 1969, he was radically improved. By a year after that, he was free of all epileptic convulsions and living a completely normal life. Major successes of this sort continued, but Arrigo would at rare times tell his close friends and family about the black crucifix that still kept appearing in his dreams. It seemed to plague him, unnerve him. At other times, though, he was unruffled and confident, still a front-page figure in Brazil, still the subject of special news bulletins on television featuring some dignitary or celebrity who told about his personal experience with Arrigo. As Arrigo TMS work became tacitly legitimatized, the more 207 prominent people flocked to him, and the more his reputation grew. He received constant long-distance calls from many major figures in the country, not merely for medical advice, but for philosophical or spiritual sustenance. When he would go to Belo Horizonte on occasion, there were few persons, if any, who did not recognize him on the street, few who did not try to stop him and shake his hand. Passing the Hotel Normandy one afternoon, Arrigo noticed a huge crowd gathered. He learned that President Arthur da Costa e Silva, with his wife, Dona Yolanda, were about to leave the hotel. Arrigo waited a few moments, and the president and his wife appeared, waved to the crowd, and started toward their waiting motorcade. Spotting Arrigo in the crowd, the president went directly to him, drew him out from behind the police barrier, and embraced him a with fire TM, as the press put it. Dona Yolanda took Arrigo TMS hand, and said, so you are Arrigo. I am happy that you can continue your work. We at TMLL do everything possible to help a TM. Arrigo kissed the First Lady at TMS hand, and the entourage drove off. Support like this bolstered Arrigo TMS helps for the new hospital, and he waited anxiously for the day that construction would begin. Ex-President Kubitschek continued his support when he returned to live in Brazil. Anticipating his return, he had written Arrigo from New York to say that he looked forward eagerly to seeing him again in Congonhas, and to be in condition to pass the days with you. I want a TM. Like the others, Kubitschek seemed to draw spiritual as well as medical strength from Arrigo. Along with the analysis of the statistics and the time-consuming preparation for the follow-up survey, several of the Americans who had visited Arrigo continued to probe the reasons why Arrigo was able to do what he did. He was constantly being compared to Edgar Cayce, the widely known American mystic. But Cayce had never plunged a knife into the viscera as Arrigo did. He was also compared to many a healer's TM, but none of them had done so, either. Acupuncture was another comparison, but Arrigo TMS surgery was far beyond it. The Philippine psychic healers, who continued to receive sporadic attention in the press, could not 208 be equated with Arrigo. There was too much evidence of pure fakery in their work. Luis Rodriguez, the retired industrialist and author who lived in Rio, kept up a running correspondence with the Acenta research group, including Belk, Puharich, and John Lawrence, on his own extensive studies of Arago. Rodriguez was an intellectual Cartesist who had come around slowly to accepting the concept that Dr. Fritz Atiyah's possession of Arago was an outright reality. Many felt that Rodriguez had gone overboard in buying this, although his reasoning was quite brilliant and persuasive. His prose was ponderous, but his thoughts were extremely cogent. His studies of psychiatry were probably as extensive as those of many of the advanced specialists in the field, and his knowledgeability was unquestioned. What was questioned was his tendency to extrapolate too much from the evidence at hand. In a lengthy letter forwarding his theories about Arago to the North American Medical Group, he wrote, "In all serious psychic research, we are basically directed to evaluate innate or native capabilities of every individual. This is because we do not find psychic manifestations in things, but in persons. Every person is a naturally endowed individual with his peculiar psychic qualities. Arago, for instance, is a man like any other man, physiologically speaking. Yet psychically, he is different from many others. A great number of people, the immense majority, do not have the slightest idea as to what psychic virtues distinguish Arago from many others. But a few do know the how and why of Arago. To these, Arago is not a mystery. To the others, he is an enigma. Arago is only a vivid example of what others could do, if interest is taken in the adequate development of the specific psychic faculties required to repeat what he is doing. Research work does not admit of the existence of personal monopolies. Knowing this, our effort is directed toward the scientific study of mediumship, its onset, maintenance, expansion, and varieties. This embraces the study of the spiritual nature of man 209, as a psychic phenomenon, beyond the limitations and contradictions of religion and mysticism. This study, however, is not possible employing the present-day limited or superficial concepts of ESP research. Arago is not an ESP phenomenon. He simply represents a link in a close and intimate teamwork device manifesting itself in the mediumistic capabilities of man, and the medical knowledge and experience of discarnate entities working in the respective specialties and spheres. It is a method in which diagnosis, treatment, and prognosis perform their unifying routine. This close collaboration between Arago and his discarnate friends cannot be understood and cannot possibly be repeated by others unless these basic hard facts of life are taken into account. 1. That man is an incarnate soul. 2. That this soul was not created at the time of birth. 3. That it has had many other lives on earth and that others will consequently follow. 4. That contact between the incarnate and discarnate persons has been taking place since man appeared on earth for the first time. 5. That the psychic faculty known as mediumship is the method devised by nature to establish this necessary and enlightening contact. 6. That primitive peoples all over the world are well acquainted with these simple facts of life. What I have learned is that it behooves us to improve the nature of this contact by enhancing its reliability, and separating it from the superstitions involved in religious creeds, doctrines, or dogmas, from rites and rituals. Likewise, not to waste time with obdurate skepticism that retards progress by postulating pseudo-scientific explanations that explain nothing. Rodriguez went on to explain that he had developed a form of hypnotism that he referred to as the AINOMETRIC 210, Transia TM, to bridge the gap. He was conducting extensive experiments with it, and was planning to organize the results in another book. His theme was that psychiatry under Freud, Adler, Jung, or any of the other pioneers in the field simply did not go far enough. He continued in his letter, "I have been preoccupied for many years with the failure of psychiatry to identify the etiology, or origin, of functional neuroses and psychoses, which in more than 80% of the cases is nothing else but symptoms and syndromes revealing the flourishing of mediumship." Author Atiyah's note, in other words, possession. Failure to identify these syndromes for what they are has converted, and is converting hundreds of thousands of individuals in the civilized world who are not sick, into schizophrenics. Mental hospitals are filled with them. This happens when electric shock, insulin, or chemical shocks are induced in them, blocking the natural manifestations of mediumship, destroying the mechanism through which the faculty manifests itself. The same occurs with the wholesale use of tranquilizers. He then referred to a Canadian study by Dr. Raymond Prince, of McGill University in Montreal, who had spent 17 months with native healers in Nigeria. Dr. Prince had discovered that their recognition of the reality of mediumship made psychosis a minor problem. Rodriguez continued in his letter, "The so-called witch doctors and spiritists of the reincarnation school all over the world quickly recognize these symptoms for what they are. As a consequence of this natural knowledge, mediumship is developed instead of psychosis. The development eradicates the psychoneurotic or psychotic condition that heralded the flowering of the mediumship faculty. This is the reason why mental diseases do not exist among these people, who may be counted in the millions. Mental diseases are, therefore, the fruit harvested by over-civilized man due exclusively to a condition of ignorance maintained by an exaggerated sense of sophistication and hallowed cultural superiority." Whether anyone agreed or disagreed with Rodriguez at TMS premises, he was putting an intense and deeply thought-out spotlight on the workings behind Arago, and was articulate in presenting his argument. Where he lost some people was in his six categorical postulates, which demanded a gymnastic leap into the outright acceptance of reincarnation, to say nothing of the existence of a soul. Neither concept could be accepted scientifically, at least, not without hard evidence. His arguments were provocative, however. He continued coming up from Rio to Congonhas to observe Arago, to see if he could throw more light on the matter. He noted that Arago himself was oblivious to any theories behind his own capacities. Arago simply carried out what he was compelled to do. He wasn't TMT really a card spiritist. He had been pulled into this strange scene without asking for it. The question provoked by Rodriguez's TMS theories was, would Arago have become psychotic if he had not given into his mediumship? Many signs are the blinding headaches, the hallucinations, and the gross insomnia indicated that he might have. As strange as he was in his clinical working hours, Arago was a normal, functioning human being, with all of his cluster of sons growing up as healthy and emotionally mature young men. And in spite of his lack of education, he had a shrewd, inborn intelligence that attracted some of the best minds in Brazil. Kubitschek, back in Brazil, kept his promise. He came to Congonhas and spent long hours with Arago. It was now late in 1970. The hospital project was almost ready to go on the drawing board. The North American medical team at TMS plans for the follow-up research were at last gelling. This time, the group was determined to complete the work they had been unable to do on the first attempt. Kubitschek promised his renewed support ere he still had wide influence in Brazil. When Kubitschek went to Arago at TMS house to say he was on 212, his way back to Rio, Arago seemed disturbed. He was not his usual, extrovert self. Kubitschek pressed him for what was wrong. Arago did not speak for some time, then he said, I do not like to say this, Mr. President, but I will soon die a violent death at TM. Kubitschek was shocked and disturbed. You don't TMT mean that at TM, he said. Arago nodded, and repeated in a sad, soft tone, I am sure I will die violently very soon. So I say goodbye to you with sadness. This is the last time we will meet at TM. Kubitschek reassured Arago that he merely was tired from overwork, but Arago smiled and shook his head. It was the image of the black crucifix again. Arago became almost obsessed by it. The day after his talk with Kubitschek, Arago met Gabriel Cater in front of the clinic door. Cater had come to tell him the good news that fresh funds had arrived for the medical center. Cater noted the same look that Kubitschek had noticed. You are tired, Arago at TM, Cater said. I am afraid, Gabriel at TM, Arago answered, A. That my mission on earth is finished. T.M. Cater pretended to laugh, then asked about his mother, who was critically ill at the time. You are right to ask about this now, T.M., Arago told him. Cater was about to go out of town for several days on a story. A. Ask me everything now, because I think you will not see me again, T.M. Arago wrote a prescription for Cater, T.M.'s mother, then embraced him warmly. Cater said, you will be all right. I know it, T.M. Arago did not T.M.T. answer, and went back to his clinic. Others heard strange things from Arago. Paulo Sors, a brother-in-law of Arago, overheard him saying that his death was near. A month before, Arago had lent his car to a friend. It had turned over and been demolished, but the friend was not hurt. Arago told his brother Walter, ah, this is the sign of the end, T.M. No one quite knew how to respond to these omens. For the most part, they tried to ignore the remarks, or attributed them to the fact that Arago T.M.'s schedule would exhaust a Superman, to say nothing of a man with a heart condition, 213, however mild. The heavy routine could quite naturally leave him in a state of depression. He continued with his long hours, at both the clinic and the pension office, taking time off only on weekends to prune his roses. Every January, Arago would take on another gargantuan, time-consuming job for himself. He would collect clothing from those who could afford to give it away, and give packages to the poor of both Congonhas do Campo and the surrounding plateau. It had become a traditional, festive event. Arago was always in the best of all possible moods for these occasions. This year, 1971, was no exception. He gathered what clothes he could, and being an enormously persuasive man, he collected a bounty quota, on this, the 10th year of his special event. On the morning of January 10th, over 500 poor townspeople gathered by the clinic in a festive spirit. Arago dispensed both the clothing and crude jokes, in equal proportion. Those who knew him well were elated to see him back in good spirits. He did not T.M.T. seem to show the despondency that had been plaguing him over the past few months. The old Arago had returned. He even took the day off from his patients, an almost unheard of event. On the next morning, January 11, 1971, he rose early as usual and walked briskly to the clinic, where already the crowd was waiting. He would have to be going to Lafayette that day, to arrange for payments and licensing of a car that he was buying from a retired police lieutenant in the town to replace his own. It was an old, blue Opel sedan, a car made in Brazil by General Motors. He explained to the patients who had gathered at the center that he would not be opening the clinic that afternoon until 3, but that he would take care of as many as possible in the morning, and the rest at the later time. Then he went about his work. He finished well before noon, and broke for an early lunch. The sky was black and ominous that day, and already the cobblestones were glistening with rain. At his house, Arlette had prepared a hot lunch for him, and two of his good friends were there to join him. One was Bedu, a 214, warm and earnest man who did odd jobs at the Hotel Freitas. He had been a close friend of the de Freitas family for years. He worshipped Arago, and made no secret of it. He was bright and witty, and constantly cheered Arago up when he was in his dimmer moods. The other friend was Antonio Ribeiro, who had learned that Arago planned to drive to Lafayette that day and wanted to hitch a ride. Arago was delighted to have company, and the group sat down with Arlette and Tarcisio, Arago T.M.'s oldest son, in his 20s. The lunch was brief, and afterward Arago had a few moments to play cards with the men before leaving. Playing cards was one of the few ways Arago could relax. By now the skies had burst, and the mountain rains were drenching the village. Arago said he would wait for a let-up before going to the car. There was light banter, and occasionally Arago would rise from the table to look out the window to see if the downpour had eased. Earlier that morning, Jose Tilda Copyright Timoto, a driver for the National Highway Department, had picked up João Felicido, who was treasurer of the department, to drive him from Rio to Belo Horizonte on a routine trip. They had left Rio at first light. The drive had gone smoothly enough, until they reached the town of Lathwaite. There, the rainstorm hit with fury, blocking visibility and turning the twisting roads into a wet slick glaze. It was about noon when they arrived at Lathwaite, and they decided to push on. Timoteau knew the roads well, it was his job.